Hunted, Book 6 in the Iron Druid Chronicles series. Written by Kevin Hearn and read by Christopher Ragland. Chapter 1. It's odd how when you feel safe, you can't think of that thing it was you kept meaning to do. But when you're running for your life, you suddenly remember the entire list of things you never got around to doing. I always wanted to get blindly drunk with a mustachioed man, take him back to his place, do a few extra shots just this side of severe liver damage, and then shave off half his mustache when he passed out. I would then install surveillance equipment before I left so that I could properly appreciate his reaction and his hangover when he woke up. And of course I would surveil him from a black windowless van parked somewhere along his street. There would be a wisecracking computer science graduate from MIT in the van with me, who almost but not quite went all the way once with a mousy physics major who dumped him because he didn't accelerate her particles. I can't remember when I thought that one up and added it to my list. It was probably after I saw True Lies. It was never particularly high up on my list, for obvious reasons, but the memory came back to me, fully fantasized in Technicolor once I was running for my life in Romania. Our minds are mysteries. Somewhere behind me, the Morrigan was fighting off two goddesses of the hunt. Artemis and Diana had decided that I needed killing, and the Morrigan had pledged to protect me from such violent death. Oberon ran on my left and Granuel on my right. All around me, the forest quaked silently with the pandemonium of Faunus, disrupting druidic tethers to Tir na n'Og. I could not shift away to safety. All I could do was run and curse the ancient Greco-Romans. Unlike the Irish and the Norse, and many other cultures, the Greco-Romans did not imagine their gods as eternally youthful but vulnerable to violent death. Oh, they had nectar and ambrosia to keep their skin wrinkle-free and their bodies in prime shape, changing their blood to ichor, and that was similar to the magical food and drink available to other pantheons. But that wasn't the end of it. They could regenerate completely, which essentially gifted them with true immortality, so that even if you shredded them like machaca and ate them with guacamole and warm tortillas, they'd just respawn in a brand new body on Olympus and keep coming after you. Hence the reason why Prometheus never died, in spite of having his liver eaten every day by a vulture who, oddly, never sought variety in his diet. That didn't mean a fella couldn't beat them. Aside from the fact that they can be slain by other immortals, the Olympians have to exist in time like everyone else. I tossed Bacchus onto an island of slow time in Tir na n'Og, and the Olympians took it personally. So personally that they'd rather kill me than get Bacchus back. I didn't think for a moment I could do the same to the huntresses. They were far more adept in combat, for one thing, and they'd be watching each other's back while doing their best to shoot me and mine.
"Where are we going?"
Granuel asked.
"Roughly north for now. Situation's fluid."
"I may have left some fluid back there when I saw those arrows coming,"
Oberon said. The Morrigan had taken both arrows in her shield and told us to run.
"I almost did too, Oberon,"
Granuel said. She could hear his voice now that she was a full druid.
"I should have been ducking or tackling Atticus or almost anything else, but instead I was just trying my damnedest not to pee."
"We'll have to take a potty break later," I said. "Distance is key right now."
"And I'm guessing stealth isn't. This is going to be an easy trail to follow the way we're moving through the forest."
"We'll get crafty when we have the space to do so." The Morrigan's raspy voice entered my head. It wasn't my favorite habit of hers, but it was convenient at the moment. Her tone was exultant.
"Here is a battle worthy of remembrance. How I wish there were witnesses and a bard like Amargin to put it down in song."
"Morrigan,
listen, Sheahan. I can keep them from pursuing you for some while, but they will hunt again soon enough."
"They will? What about you?"
"I am better than they, but not immortal. My end is near. I have seen it. But what an end it will be!"
I slowed down and looked back. Granuel and Oberon paused too.
"You're going to die?"
"Don't stop running, you fool! Run and listen and do not sleep. You know how to stave off the need to sleep, don't you?
Yes, prevent the buildup of adenosine in the brain and...
Enough with the modern words, you know. Now you must either find one of the old ways to Tir na n'Og, one that isn't guarded, or make your way to the Forest of Hearn the Hunter.
The Forest of Hearn? You mean Windsor Forest? That's a hell of a run across Europe.
You can always die instead,
the Morrigan pointed out. No thanks, but Windsor is not much of a wilderness anymore. It's more like a groomed park. People drink tea there. They might even play croquet. That's not a forest.
It will suffice. Hearn is there. He will defend it, and he will bring friends. And Sheehan, remember that Gaia loves us more than she loves the Olympians. They have given her nothing in all their long lives. Even now they traumatize her with pandemonium. I am unbinding their chariots. They will be afoot for some while until their smith gods can make them anew. Take advantage and give yourself as much of a lead as possible.
Something didn't compute. Morrigan, if you saw this coming, why didn't you warn me?
You were with your woman.
My woman? If I tried to call Granuel that, I would promptly lose some teeth. She's not mine. You can't possess anyone.
I have learned that lesson very well.
Fine. Then what does that have to do with this ridiculous fight with the Olympians? We could have avoided it all.
No. It was always going to come. Delaying would do no good.
Are you kidding? That's what living is. Delaying death. Let's get you some Prozac.
Hush. I have for you what modern people call a lovely parting gift.
I shuddered to think what the Morrigan considered lovely, so I simply said, a parting gift?
In Tir na n'Og, there is a time island with the following address.
A vision appeared in my head of a short stone obelisk etched with Ogham script.
Do you see it?
Yes, but...
Record it well in your memory. Circle the island. On the side facing upstream, look closely at the tree line, and you will see someone there you might wish to retrieve. If you do, ask Govnu for help.
Morrigan. Why?
Because I am trapped, and this is the only way out. And because you have chosen, and you have chosen well, I cannot
falter. I lost a step or two as the import of her words sank in. Granuel shot a worried glance at me, and I shook my head once, reassuring her that nothing was wrong. But, Morrigan, you never said anything.
Would it have mattered? Would you have ever chosen me?
I don't know, but I didn't get a chance.
Every day was a chance, Sheehan. 2,000 years of days. If you were interested, you had ample opportunity to express it. I understand. I frighten you. I frighten everyone, and that is a fact I cannot escape, however I may wish otherwise.
Well, yeah, you're fighting off two Olympians right now and having this conversation. That's frightening.
They came prepared. Their fabrics are synthetic. I cannot bind them. And they are very skilled, trying to wound my right side and affect my magic.
Morrigan, just get out of there. You saved me and we have a lead now.
No. This is the choice I have made. It is only recently I have tried to change in earnest. I mean, since you slew Angus Oak and discovered that somehow change has become impossible for me. I cannot make friends. I cannot be gentle except under the most extraordinary circumstances. My nature will not allow it. All I can do is terrify, seduce, and choose the slain. Is that not strange? Long ago, I was merely a druid like you, and could do whatever I wished. But once I became a goddess, certain expectations came with the power. Call them chains, rather. I didn't notice them until I tried to break free. My nature now is no longer my own to do with as I please. I can be only what my people want me to be.
I'm sorry. I didn't know.
I tell you so that you may grow wiser. It is a hidden law of godhood, and woe unto she who finds it. I have been trying to deny its reality, but it has asserted itself too often to be anything but the truth. Yet, I have some comfort now.
You do?
Here is my victory, Shion. I am permitted to do battle, and I do not need a reason. Still, I usually have one, and that reason can be whatever I wish. So today, I do not fight for glory or honor or bloodlust or vengeance. I fight for something else.
I understand. But say it anyway, for the win.
Love.
Morgan, I felt as if something popped softly in my head, like the release of tension when a taut cord is cut, or a binding. There was a sudden emptiness, and an overwhelming sense of vertigo caused me to stumble over a root and execute a graceless faceplant.
Morgan?
The silence in my head pointed to only one conclusion. Our mental bond had been like the soft electric hum of kitchen appliances or computers that you never notice until they stop. During a rather painful ritual that had regenerated an ear I'd lost to a demon, she'd slipped in the binding that allowed her to speak to me telepathically. It was gone now.
Atticus, what happened?
Granuel helped me to my feet and gasped when she saw my face.
Are you hurt? Why are you crying?
She let go of my arm, and then had to grab it again when I swayed on my feet, still a bit dizzy.
The Morrigan is dead, I said.
Chapter 2. Think you can carry your staff in your mouth as a horse? I asked, to forestall any questions about what happened. I rubbed away my tears with the heel of my palm. Granuel understood and didn't press the issue, though her voice sounded hollowed out by shock.
I suppose I could.
Good. Leave your clothes here. I began to strip and tried to clear my head of its dizziness by taking several deep breaths. We really need to make time. We'll hoof it and recharge from the earth as we go. Granuel peeled off her shirt.
The Morrigan said the old ways would be collapsed or guarded,
she said, recalling what the goddess had said to us before we took off running.
Are we going to fight our way through and use one of those?
I think we'll be running all the way to England, or to France anyway, then we'll swim the channel.
We're seriously running there from Romania?
That's right.
We can't take a train or boost a car or something?
No, you heard what the Morrigan said. The only way she saw us survive is running the whole way.
That doesn't make sense.
When it comes to our survival, I don't want to bet against the Morrigan's visions. She tended, to be accurate on matters of life and death.
I'm not trying to argue the truth of what she said. I just want to understand why it's true.
I shrugged. I don't know the answer yet. We'll find out as we go. My guess is that we'll have to figure out everything on the run. Once divested of our clothing, with our weapons lying on the ground in front of us, we shifted to our hoofed forms, a stag and a chestnut mare, and picked up our weapons in our mouths.
Heh, you guys better hope we don't run into a thick patch where the trees grow really close together,
Oberon said. I didn't have a reply for that, but Granuel must have, because Oberon followed that up with an outraged,
What? Seriously? Do I have to?
She obviously said he did, for he continued,
We need to get you some saddlebags or something.
He picked up one of Granuel's thigh holsters, where she kept 3 leaf-bladed throwing knives.
You know how ridiculous we look, right? I know a horse whisperer, and I'm totally going to give him a call about you.
The one-sided banter continued as we began to run, and I was grateful for it. Someone I had thought of as eternal had abruptly ended, and it rocked me. I couldn't have summoned a single playful riposte to Oberon's comments. There was simply too much else for me to deal with, not least of which was figuring out how we would continue to survive. Once out of the foothills of the Apuseni Mountains, we were able to pour on the speed.
skirting along the edge of a small plateau and then, descending out of the wilderness, running across flat, cultivated lands. We bore northwest to avoid crossing more hills and slowing down. We kept to the vineyards and alfalfa and cereal crops and avoided the villages. We swam across two rivers and crossed into Hungary by running south of Oradea as the sun set. Through Oberon, I relayed to Granuel what the Morrigan had said. The bits about getting to Hearn's Forest, anyway. Her question to me?
What route shall we take to get there?
Our best chance was in simple speed, unless we could somehow find an old way to Tir na n'Og that wasn't monitored. I had no doubt that those would all be watched. The people behind planning this wanted to make sure they got us, and they wouldn't be able to if we could get to Tir na n'Og and then shift to another plane entirely. The Romans had done the same thing to the ancient druids when they tried to wipe us out with the help of vampires and the Roman goddess Minerva. Step one had been to burn all the sacred groves on the continent, which were the only tethers to Tir na n'Og at the time. Step two was to guard all the old ways, and step three was to use Minerva's aid to see through our camouflage. I'd managed to escape them by running north beyond the boundaries of the Roman Empire. I would not be surprised to learn that Minerva had advised Pan, Faunus, and the Huntresses how to hunt us now. But I had never tried to run across Europe before. I'd hiked it once and stayed in youth hostels and put little patches on my backpack because I thought it was a funny disguise, but I took my time doing that, and climbing up mountains was an experience to be savored. I rather thought dealing with mountains now would do nothing but slow us down, and besides, I didn't want to telegraph our intended destination. To get to the Strait of Dover directly, we could simply run north of west and hit it. But that route would present us not only with several mountain ranges, but plenty of well-paved cities like Budapest and Vienna. We needed misdirection, and the ability to keep in touch with the earth at all times. That's why I took a sharp turn north at the Hungarian border. Once we crossed the Carpathians, we could stick to flattish land or, at the worst, low rolling hills all the way to France. While we moved northwest through Poland and Germany, we'd keep them thinking we were headed for Sweden via Denmark. To get the best possible route, however, avoiding the majority of villages, while also minimizing our exposure to survivalists in the woods awaiting the apocalypse, I would need to consult elementals along the way. Using my Latin headspace, I reached out to the Carpathian elemental, who was dominant across several human political borders that were meaningless to Gaia. Druids run. Need guidance. Avoid people and cities if possible. After some back and forth with Carpathia, we settled on a route that would take us north through rural areas of Hungary and Slovakia until we reached the proper Carpathian Mountains. With a plan in place and an hour of trail behind us, I had time to feel, and much of that feeling leaked out of my eyes as I ran. I had spent nearly my entire life worshipping the Morrigan, and in recent years more than that. She was the darkness for me, an unexpectedly beautiful harbinger of doom and pain who forced me to struggle, who pushed me to improve myself. She was a necessary balance to Briett, not something merely to be feared, but to be treasured. As Briett brought light and craft and poetry to our lives, the Morrigan brought an edge, a tangible sharpness to my existence by sharing hers with me. With the clarity of hindsight, I saw the signs that the Morrigan had favored me far more than she had the average mortal. 6 years ago, especially, when she took me away from Granuel to repair the tattoos on the back of my hand, she'd been uncharacteristically candid with me. But I had dismissed it because we were in a room enchanted with bindings that encouraged harmony. Now I saw that our interlude there had been haunting her ever since. As soon as she left that room, she reverted to her cruel self, when she had not necessarily wished to do so. And that was what made her snap. Not her love for some dude, but her lack of freedom to love or not as she desired. I tried to be her friend, which probably made it all worse. We'd gone to a few baseball games together simply to hang out, and she couldn't keep herself from remarking on the fear of failure the players felt, or their guilt or despair at poor performance,
and only noticed their triumphs when I observed them aloud. Each time I did, she cringed, taking it as a rebuke. She seemed to think she should have seen it first, or at least at the same time, but she had a filter blocking all such things from her sight. Each time we'd gone out to the ballpark, she began the night flushed with optimism, convinced that this time she would be able to enjoy the competition and my company on a purely superficial level, and ignore all the feelings she was attuned to feel as a goddess associated with death and war and lust. Usually that optimism had fled by the third inning, and she sat in silence, distrusting herself to say anything lest it be perceived as accentuating the negative. My attempts to cheer her up with happy observations only emphasized that she lacked the social facility to engage on that level. We caught a game in St. Louis once, and after a quick visit to the team shop, I was struck by how different she looked in a Cardinals jersey and cap. She looked damn cute. Not hot or sultry or sexy, but the sort of innocent, wholesome beauty that lifts your spirit and makes you grateful to be alive to see it. But when I told the Morrigan she looked cute, she didn't understand the nuance, nor did she appreciate it when I tried to explain it to her. She thought I was asking for sex, discovered that I wasn't, and then we both felt frustrated and embarrassed. Despite these failures, I thought that we were making progress, becoming friends after 2 millennia of being uneasy allies against Angus Oak. I suppose the Morrigan didn't feel the progress was sufficient or of the right kind. Perhaps just as frustrating for her was the inability to enlist the aid of an iron elemental in binding a cold iron amulet to her aura. No matter how she tried, she could not free herself from the conditions of her godhood and project friendliness. I suppose she was free now. Most importantly, free of those constraints and, to a lesser extent, of an idiot druid who never recognized her true feelings. If I had looked at her in the magical spectrum, I might have seen those emotional bonds, much as Granuel had seen them between us soon after she'd gained her magical sight. But I never dared to look at the Morrigan that way. She would know, and consider it an invasion of privacy, and she dealt with such invasions harshly. I supposed I was free now too, but unlike the Morrigan, I didn't want to be. Ridiculous as it seemed, I wanted to see her eyes flash red at me again and tell me I was doomed. I wanted to see another baseball game with her and train her in the hallowed yet disgusting art of chewing sunflower seeds. And, admittedly, I wanted to feel protected again. She'd been the only one looking out for me. Without the Morrigan's aegis, I was once again vulnerable to violent death. That had been the case for the vast majority of my long life, of course, but I knew I would miss the last 12 years of relative security. The frequency of attempts on my life had increased dramatically since I'd decided to stop running from Angus Oak, and having a goddess in my corner had been a comfort. Her aid had been sporadic and never free of pain, but without it, I would certainly already be dead. With her gone now and 2 immortals on my trail, perhaps the sand in my hourglass was finally running out. We quickly discovered that all 3 of us running in concealment was impractical. We lost one another and spread out unintentionally or even bumped into each other. I remained visible, since a stag running through fields was not all that remarkable and decidedly no cause for alarm. Someone might try to round up Granuel as a horse, however, and Oberon might be reported as a stray. It was easiest for Granuel to remain completely invisible and Oberon camouflaged, and in such a fashion they followed my lead. Unaided, we were pretty fast critters. Each of us could reach 30 miles an hour and maintain that for perhaps 1 or 3 miles before we had to rest. But, with Gaia's help, we could push that to 40 to 45 miles an hour and keep it up indefinitely, replenishing spent muscles and preventing oxygen debt. The eastern half of Slovakia is largely rural, and we had an easy time of it, especially after everyone had gone home for the evening. We slowed down to cross the occasional road or vault a low fence, but otherwise stayed in a zone and ran without speaking, hopefully developing a gap that the huntresses would never be able to close.
Our first trouble waited for us to the north of a lake called Velká Domasa. Domasa was oriented north to south, formed by a dam on the Ondava River. It was about 8 miles long, and its surface, silvered with reflected moonlight, had slid by on our left as we ran through the forested hills on its eastern side. It was one of those mature forests that give humans a sense of security, because the undergrowth had been either choked out or taught to mind its manners and couldn't hide large, man-eating predators. People hiked through it and preyed on wild mushrooms instead. We slipped down from the hills after we'd cleared a wee town on its northeastern shore, a village of maybe 500 people that I later learned was called Tarani Nad Andavu. At that point, Oberon's nose picked up something, and so did mine.
Hey, Isaacus, either something's dead, or there's a vampire around here somewhere.
I smell it too, I replied.
Clever girl says she smells it.
Okay, let's just chill here a second and tell her not to shift. If she switches to human, the vampire will sense her.
Doesn't he sense us now?
We're harmless animals now, and he's probably looking for humans. There was a road ahead of us that led to a border crossing, and thus a pass through the Carpathians. The plan was to follow roughly along its eastern side. I saw nothing on the road heading north, but scanning to the south, back toward the town, I saw four figures, two on either side of the road. They were all looking south and clearly waiting for something. They wore jeans and hoodies with the hoods pulled up, hands jammed into their pockets. Triggering magical sight, I saw that one had the telltale gray aura of a vampire. The other three were far more dangerous in my view. Dark elves, I said.
Granuel says she wants to set them on fire.
I gave a sort of mental snort. The dark elves wouldn't remain solid long enough to burn. I should probably quip here that revenge is a dish best served cold.
You need to explain that saying sometime. You say it like it's a bad thing, but to me it suggests ice cream, because that's also best served cold. I think more people would seek revenge if it were served with ice cream, or maybe gelato, or frozen yogurt, but not the kind with fruit mixed in.
Oberon?
Yeah?
Ask Granuel seriously if she wants to take them out or keep running. There was a pause before the answer came.
She says yes. She doesn't want them joining up with the goddesses and ganging up on us. But we need to do it quick if we're going to do it.
She was right about that. The huntresses would be coming along and we couldn't delay. It occurred to me that perhaps the elves' sole function was to delay us. The last time we'd encountered dark elves was in Thessalonica, and we barely escaped. There were fewer of them here, however, and Granuel was now a full druid with powers they probably did not expect. Did the vampire know what we could do to him? He might be a young one and somewhat out of the loop regarding druids, but I saw his utility to the group. He was a sensor array. We would not be able to sneak up on them unawares. He'd smell us or hear us far in advance. I'll unbind the vampire first and charge from here in plain view. Granuel should stay invisible and flank the dark elves. If she uses magical sight, she should be able to keep track of them in the dark when they turn to smoke. Granuel shifted, but remained invisible, and evidently had a complaint when she asked Oberon for her throwing knives, for I heard my hounds say,
Schlapper is just one of the many fine services I provide for free.
Oberon, please stay here. There's nothing you can bite down there.
Okay, that's fine with me. I've been meaning to do some serious maintenance of the undercarriage, if you know what I mean, and you guys always freak out when I go downtown.
Tell Granuel she can go. I'm going to unbind the vampire now. I shifted to human and focused on the vampire, speaking the words that would separate him into nothing more than carbon, water, and trace elements. With him gone, the dark elves would have to rely on their more limited senses. I heard Granuel's footsteps fade as she ran down the slope toward the road. She would flank them to the north while I would be charging in from the northeast. Alerted by something he either smelled or heard, the vampire turned and pointed in my direction. But he crumpled inside his clothing once I energized the binding,
and his jeans dropped to the ground with a sort of red sludge spilling out the legs. I dropped my camouflage, drew Fragora, and charged, naked and howling, just like we Celts used to do in the good old days. For their part, the Dark Elves dropped all pretense of being human. Upon the vampire's demise, they pulled out page one of their playbook from Sieg af Rake, the martial art that means victory from smoke, and turned incorporeal to avoid getting stabbed or shot or otherwise ambushed. It would have been a fabulous tactic against someone who couldn't view them in the magical spectrum. They would have melted into the night and been untraceable. But I could see them plainly as clouds of white energy, and furthermore, I knew they could maintain their smoke forms for only 5 seconds. They could spend as little as 1 second in corporeal form before turning to smoke again, but for that 1 second they would be vulnerable, and if I was right, once they were wounded, they couldn't go smoky again until they healed. Each would have a black knife bonded to him that could dissolve and reform like his body, but as such, it was magical and couldn't penetrate my aura. Granuel and Oberon could be hurt by those knives, however, so I wanted the Dark Elves to try to stab me all they wanted while Granuel bushwhacked them. As I pelted down the hill and crossed the field to their position by the road, I noticed that they weren't heading for trees on the far side of the road or forming up to face me. They were remaining in their positions, solidifying briefly and then going smoky again, but waiting for me to close that gap. That was odd. Alarm bells went off in my head, and I stopped yelling as I tried to figure out what was up. There were no telltales of a magical booby trap, but perhaps they decided to go with something more mundane. They could have planted mines around their position, and I would blow myself up. Oberon, tell Granuel to approach on the road. There might be mines. I contacted Carpathia. Query, shallow buried metal ahead of my current path? Yes. I stopped running. Show me. The images filtered into my head. A semicircle of M16A2 bounding anti-personnel mines surrounded the Dark Elves on either side of the road, but easily 200 feet from their position. It was an American design. They were scattered throughout the Middle East and Asia. Step on one, remove your foot, and the mine would pop out of the ground about 3 feet into the air before detonating and spraying shrapnel for 100 feet in every direction. To avoid detection, they would have been wiser to plant the modern blast mines that used a minimum of metal, but they probably were counting on me being stupid. I was still a safe distance away and could detonate them remotely. I'm not brilliant at shifting earth, but I can move a bit of topsoil when I need to. Oberon, tell Granuel to stop and hit the deck for a few seconds. Targeting a circle of sod near me, I bound it to the top of the first mine. The turf flew through the air and triggered the bounder when it landed and rolled off. The explosion boomed in the night, and shredded bits of iron sprayed out and fell harmlessly between us. I repeated the exercise until all the mines had been detonated. Silly Dark Elves. Earth is for druids. Still, they refused to move. When they solidified, they were looking in my direction, but they kept their positions by the road. That meant they had some other kind of protection and wanted me to charge in. I wouldn't do that because doing what the enemy wants is tantamount to taking a bath with a kitchen appliance. They might have another ring of those plastic mines after all. Carpathia would have a tough time sensing them, except perhaps as displaced soil. Warn Granuel to look for more booby traps. They're too comfortable there. Take them out from the maximum distance possible.
Okay,
Oberon said. I beckoned the elves to come forward, but once they saw this, which proved they had excellent night vision, they remained solid and copied the motion, white smiles splitting their faces. I smiled back and watched one on the far side of the road take a throwing knife in the side of his neck. So nice of him to remain still and present a target like that for Granuel. His partner immediately went smoky, but the remaining Dark Elf on my side didn't see it happen because he was facing me. I kept smiling at him and gesturing, and in another couple of seconds he went down too. The last Dark Elf had to turn solid after his 5 seconds were up, but he tried to be clever about it and solidified in a crouch, presenting a smaller target. Granuel anticipated it and nailed him anyway. It wasn't a fatal shot, catching him in the shoulder, but my theory proved true. They couldn't dissolve their substance once their skin was broken. He clutched the knife and cursed in Old Norse, remaining crouched on the ground. "Tell Granuel to head back to you and leave the knives. We'll get her some more. He's neutralized now, and I don't want to risk walking into a trap we can't see." After a pause, Oberon replied,
"She says last one to the hound is a really old guy."
I grinned and sprinted back up the hill, leaving the lone dark elf behind to watch the bodies of his comrades melt to black tar. A regular infusion of immortality might be keeping my body from aging, but Granuel made me feel young again. Chapter 3. The only way dark elves and a vampire could have been waiting at that particular spot long enough to plant landmines was if somebody had known we'd be running through there. That suggested a couple of things. Either the Olympians tipped them off, which I thought unlikely because they wouldn't achieve their measure of glory if they let someone else kill me, or someone was following the Morgan's movements and made an educated guess about our route. That someone was most likely Faye. Few others would have a chance to move around the Irish plains without being seen. Guessing our route wouldn't have been that difficult if one assumed we were headed north. There were a few passes through the Carpathians, and following a river was one of the easiest ways to shake a tail. You cross it again, you pretend to cross, but really you just run in the shallow water until you re-emerge a bit upstream on the same side. Sitting on a river that led more or less straight to the pass was a fair gamble. I said to Granuel, "We may have a fairy tale."
"Yeah, this is the kind of fairy tale with children who wander off and get in trouble in the forest. Usually they die because they don't have a wolfhound along. Or parents. You ever notice the rampant child neglect going on in fairy tales?"
"No, Oberon. I said we might have a fairy tale, as in a fairy who is tailing us." My hound whined.
"English is stupid sometimes."
"Look up once in a while. It's clearly not only the goddesses hunting us. We still have vampires and dark elves to worry about, and I think they're getting help from someone in Tir na n'Og."
"Does anyone like us?"
Granuel asked, an edge of bitterness to her voice.
"Because I'm thinking maybe we should go hang out with them if we survive this."
"Yeah, we should probably get out of Europe for a while if we can." Granuel exhaled quickly, banishing wishful thinking and returning to practical matters.
"But first things first, right? We have to get out of this fix. Would it be ridiculous to booby-trap our tail?"
"No, I don't think so. In fact, I think it's strategically necessary."
"Agreed. Even a failed trap will cause them to slow down and be wary for more. We should make a pit trap with spikes in the bottom. You make the pit and I'll make the spikes."
I grinned at her. A cold suggestion of mayhem? That's hot. Granuel dropped her staff, stepped forward and placed her hands flat against my chest. Her face darted toward mine for a quick kiss, but then pulled back at the last instant, leaving me with the heat of her breath and the scent of strawberry lip gloss. I don't think she was wearing any. Beauty products tend not to survive the rigors of shape-shifting, but I always smelled it now, regardless. The memory of it was indelibly linked with the sight of her lips. She pushed me away, hard, and shapeshifted to a horse. She picked up her staff in her mouth and galloped north at full speed, leaving me bewildered and more than a little wistful. Oberon's mental groan came a few seconds later.
"She says if you want any, you have to beat her to the other side of the Carpathians."
I broke into a wide smile before dropping Fragral's scabbard on the ground and shapeshifting to a stag. "Giddy up," I said to him, picking the sword up in my mouth.
"Have I ever shared with you my opinion of human mating habits?"
The race, I eventually discerned, was in earnest. I spent half of it like a confident waffle dolphin, thinking she would slow down and let me win.
But then I tried to close the gap and found that she hadn't been going full speed after all. She had a sixth and seventh gear.
"Clarify some slang for me, Atticus," Oberon asked.
"Sure.
Is this what humans call a quickie?"
The horse in front of me whinnied in amusement. Granuel could, of course, hear Oberon too, but I wasn't gaining on her, so I didn't think it was funny. We were running either in or near the trees on the east side of Highway E371 to keep from drawing the attention of drivers crossing the border between Slovakia and Poland. This was Dukla Pass, site of one of the bloodiest battles of the Eastern Front during World War II. Farmhouses and memorials for the dead sat like squat chess pieces on squares of pasture framed by stands of timber. Once past the border and safely on the other side of the pass, Granuel paused to gloat at the edge of an alfalfa field.
"Guess you'll have to rechannel all your sexual energy into making a death trap for immortals," she said.
"Eh, you guys have fun constructing impossibilities in the dark. I'm taking a nap."
A nap sounded like a great idea to me, but we couldn't afford the time. If we slept now, we might never wake up, so we concentrated on our task. Normally, a pit trap would take many hours, and a handy tool like a shovel or a backhoe, or at least a spade, with which to move the earth. But it doesn't take that long and requires no tools at all when the earth is willing to do all the work for you. The trick is to be smart about it when you have two expert huntresses on your tail. "We can't have you cutting down branches here and sharpening stakes," I said. "If they have night vision or they come through here after dawn, there's too much chance that they'll see it and be wary. Let's cross the pasture on the hoof and leave a clear trail. Once we get to the other side, we pull a waskowy wabbit and tunnel back, you see?"
"They surely do."
She shifted to a horse, took up her staff, and galloped across.
"Oh, I guess this means I don't get that nap."
"Not here, anyway. Across the field of joy. Here, take Fragral with you, too. Tell Granuel to get started, and I'll be there soon. I need to snag some flashlights from the border station." Oberon opened his mouth extra wide to carry both my scabbard and Granuel's knives.
"This is getting ridiculous. I want a deluxe package at a doggy day spa to alleviate my trauma," he said.
"Enough complaining."
"I'm not complaining. I'm lobbying. It's this whole other word."
I doubled back in camouflage, not caring if the huntresses saw the footprints. Let them follow me to the guard station at the border and wonder what I did there. What I did was throw a couple of rocks at the guardhouse windows. Two guards obligingly came out with flashlights shining into the night, resting their hands on the butts of their guns and calling out warnings to the dark. I snatched their flashlights away, turned them off, and then cast camouflage on them. From the guards' point of view, the flashlights had leapt out of their hands and disappeared. They drew their guns, but they couldn't find a target in the dark. I was already running back to the alfalfa field, chased by Polish curses that seemed to Doppler shift bizarrely into "never gonna give you up," and after I thought of it, I couldn't believe I just rickrolled myself. Once I reached the field, I kept trucking across it with my human feet. There was no need to switch up my form for consistency. All the goddesses needed to do was follow me across. Underneath the opposite cover of trees, we made contact with Carpathia. Granuel wanted a bit of help and some permission to harvest some living tree branches, while I explained the tunnel we needed and then the pit in the middle of the pasture that needed to be hollowed out while leaving the surface undisturbed. Artemis and Diana needed to see that swath of trampled alfalfa and follow directly in our paths. Despite Carpathia's aid, building the trap took an hour. Moving the earth and hidden rocks in the ground wasn't that much trouble for the elemental, only the work of a few minutes or so, but it took us multiple trips through the tunnel to populate the pit with sharpened stakes. We could carry only so much, because we had to carry the flashlights, too. Our night vision was sufficient for the work outside, but that wouldn't cut it in the total darkness of underground. Planting the stakes in the bottom of the pit so that they'd remain steady took the majority of the time. The pit itself was rather deep at 20 feet, and Oberon was impressed. To him, it was an epic feat of engineering.
How deep is this compared to that one in Sparta where the Persian diplomats got kicked?
Not nearly so deep, I replied.
What if you were like an evil cyborg longing for redemption and you wanted to throw the Emperor with lightning fingers down here? Would he go whoosh when he hit the bottom?
He'd go something, but probably not whoosh. I was worried that the goddesses would avoid the stakes somehow. Their teams would fall in first, after all, and they might land on their teams and thereby avoid injury. I wanted it to be difficult to hop out if they somehow managed to avoid the stakes, and even I don't have a 20-foot vertical leap. But what if they had some sort of levitation enchantment on their chariots? In the brief glimpse of the chariots that I'd had before the goddesses fired at us, I thought the chariots were floating slightly off the ground. I couldn't recall if their teams had been floating too. If so, then we'd probably wasted an hour. But if not, then the stags would fall in and drag the chariot down by their harness. Maybe. I hoped that, one way or another, falling into the pit would cause the goddesses at least an hour's inconvenience, if not more, in addition to slowing down their subsequent rate of pursuit. The Morrigan had bought us a few hours of time when she had unbound their chariots, since they had to wait a while to get new ones from Hephaestus and Vulcan. We were eating into that time now. With luck, the pit trap would gain us half a day's lead on them. The roof of the pit was nothing but a finely woven carpet of alfalfa roots, strengthened with a binding in the middle to prevent sagging. Carpathia closed up the tunnel behind us as we left. We hoofed it out of there to the northwest, loping downhill now, planning to skirt the Polish city of Jasło to the southwest. By following that general course, keeping to rural areas as best we could, but darting into villages here and there to get what we needed, we would avoid all the mountainous terrain of Poland and Germany. Once into the Netherlands, we could swing south and west through Belgium until we hit Calais, France. Journeys sound so easy when you string together destinations in a sentence, but one does not simply run into Britain. Chapter 4. I don't think people today fully understand the genius of The X-Files, a sci-fi show that dominated much of the 90s. It had a way of getting into your head. At least, it got into mine in ways that I didn't realize until later. Smoking men in suits now filled me with existential dread, for example. Whatever I'm doing when I see one calmly sucking hundreds of toxins into his lungs, I feel somehow that the smoking man manipulated me into doing it. I then have to flee and do something random in order to feel that I am not a pawn in his master plan. And let's just not talk about bees, okay? Mostly the series taught me to fear silhouettes in open spaces backlit by strange lights. That's why a thrill of fear shot down my spine when I saw 13 figures waiting in an onion field to the west of Jasło. Maybe they had Mulder's sister. Maybe we wouldn't be able to kill them unless we stabbed a shiv into the base of their skulls. Maybe they were dark elves. The light providing the silhouettes wasn't coming from behind them, I saw as I drew closer, but rather surrounded them in various shades of purple. They seemed like silhouettes because they wore black, but the lights swirling around them were familiar and lit up some faces I knew. They were wards I recognized. These were the Sisters of the Three Auroras, the Polish coven led by Malina Sokołowski, with whom I had signed a non-aggression treaty years ago. Malina was in front, her wards the most colorful and undoubtedly the strongest, and her long blonde hair was still breathtakingly beautiful. She hadn't aged a day in 12 years, and neither had I. But circumstances had certainly changed. The other members of her coven that I recognized, Roxana, Claudia, Kazimira, and Berta, were grouped close to Malina. She had 8 new members of the coven who had never signed the treaty, and I had Granuel who hadn't signed it either. If Malina wanted to get nasty, she technically could via her proxies. Granuel wasn't protected from spells, as I was, but she could get nasty too. Through Oberon, I communicated to Granuel that we should shift back to human and slow down. She shifted simultaneously with me, and we approached at a slow jog, weapons in hand.
They fight with silver knives, I muttered to her before we came into hailing distance. Faster than human.
Got it.
And don't stare at their parts. They use alluring charms to control people.
How lovely. Sounds complicated. They could control me by using kielbasa.
Melina sounded surprised when she addressed me, though it might have been an affectation.
Mr. O'Sullivan, what are you doing here?
She did not add, naked, in an onion field, but it was in her expression. Miss Sokolovsky, I could ask you the same.
It's Sokolovska, in Poland. There are genitive endings on names here that I didn't bother with in America.
Ah, thank you. I really do need to learn Polish. It seems congratulations are in order. Your coven is strong again.
Yes, we are. And it appears there is another druid in the world.
Indeed. Melina, this is Gronuel. The two of them exchanged pleasantries, and then Melina, as was her habit, got straight to business, ignoring our nudity.
We divined some great cataclysm to come. Might you know anything about that?
Well, yeah. It's Ragnarok. She thought I was being flippant.
I'm serious, Mr. O'Sullivan.
So am I. The last time we met, at Four Peaks Brewery in Tempe, I was about to screw everything up for everybody. I'm fairly certain I succeeded. Now I'm trying to do what I can to delay its coming or soften the blow if I can't stop it. I think we have a year left before it all goes pear-shaped.
Why a year?
Well, Loki is free from his long imprisonment, and Hel has a massive army to deploy against the Nine Realms. They could have started it already, you see, but they haven't because we've distracted them and wounded their confidence. And I'm counting on a prophecy which pointed to next year. Melina scoffed.
Whose prophecy?
The Sirens who tempted Odysseus. Melina exchanged a look with Claudia, the waifish witch who always looked like she'd just completed erotic exercises. She managed to wear her clothes in such a way that you were certain she hadn't been wearing them a minute ago.
The Sirens told Odysseus that Ragnarok would begin next year?
I shrugged. Not in so many words, but the evidence does point that way. They said the world would burn. Loki is quite the pyromaniac, and I have no doubt that once Surtur leaves Muspelheim, there will be much aflame. But honestly, I don't know what the prophecy truly means. Maybe they're talking about lots of forest fires during an especially hot summer.
I doubt that. The Sirens did not speak idly to heroes of insignificant events.
Ah, so you've heard about their accuracy.
Indeed. Is there something we can do? Because our divination suggested some sort of fire would be started here.
It did?
Yes. You know I do not joke about such things.
Well, yeah, but I don't know why a fire would start... What? Gronuel had tapped me on the shoulder to get my attention. Once she had it, she pointed up. Oh, I said. Now it makes sense. Incoming! A large ball of fire was headed straight for us, arcing out of the western sky. We gave ground, and a palpable shockwave buffeted us when the fireball hit the earth. A 12-foot-tall madman cackled in the midst of it while clasping his hands together in glee.
There!
Loki said, his face intensely pleased.
Found ye!
Chapter 5. I drew Fragora and charged him. There was no time to talk. He could set everyone on fire with a wave of his hand, so I preferred that he focus on me rather than watch him cook Gronuel and Oberon to ashes. I was a little fire-shy after getting cooked myself by some dark elves, but Loki's fire was the magical sort, and I knew my cold iron aura would protect me from it. He giggled as his right hand disappeared, and the stump of his wrist became a flamethrower. Heat rained down on me as I leapt at him and slashed down with my sword. He was quick and stepped back, but I opened up a long wound down his right thigh. Loki roared and turned off the flames. His eyes boggled at me as his head twitched. I should have been barbecued, but clearly wasn't.
You can't burn us, Loki Firestarter, I said. We're all protected. You're not protected, I told Oberon with a quick thought. Get Granuaile out of range.
Wait.
Loki waggled a finger at me and squinted.
Ye are no construct, he managed. Dwarves say they don't know ye. Liar!
Who cares what the dwarfs know or don't know? I smiled in a fashion that I hoped was unsettling. He was already mentally unstable and might therefore be more susceptible to intimidation. All you need to know is this. I'm the guy who's going to kill you. Loki's eyes widened, and he took a couple of steps back as I advanced. But then his right arm disappeared behind him. He arched his back a bit, and the arm reappeared holding a very long sword that ignited from guard to tip as I watched. I frowned. Now, where exactly did you pull that from? His daughter Hel had done something similar. She kept her knife Famine lodged between her lower ribs on her left side. She must have learned the trick of using the body as a scabbard from dear old Dad. As shapeshifters, they would have the knack.
Kind of weak-ass the meaning of the word badass, doesn't it?
Oberon, tell Granuaile to talk to the witches. They need to charm Loki if they can.
Okay, but it makes you wonder what he'd look like on one of those airport body scans.
Loki's eyes went dark, and he raised his sword. Hurry, Oberon! The flaming blade fell, but I wasn't there. I leapt directly at him again, because the best thing you can do when facing someone with enormous reach is to get inside it. I didn't hack or stab at him, but delivered a straight kick between his hips, right in his center of gravity. He doubled over, let go of the sword as he staggered, and then fell heavily. I heard Polish behind me, but kept my eyes on Loki. He shrank and morphed and sprang to his feet. This time, as a Vedic demon with blue skin, four arms, and a blade that he pulled directly out of his body in each hand. He smiled with especially sharp teeth and twirled the swords at me, and I didn't have time to wonder until much later how he'd ever come across that particular form. I had to fight my feet not to give ground. It had been quite some time since I'd practiced against more than two blades. When I was younger, and everyone had a sword, you were more likely to run into that sort of thing. Nowadays, you were more likely to run into multiple guns than multiple swords. Loki's newly black eyes shifted from my face to a point over my right shoulder. He blinked hard, blinked harder, shook his head, and his sword stopped moving. He tried to refocus on me, but his eyes drew away once more, and this time he flinched backward and dropped a couple of his weapons. The hands slapped at his eye sockets, and then he pressed his palms into them.
No, no, stop!
Worried about me, he lowered his hands and peeked over his fingers to make sure I wasn't about to run him through. That's when Melina stepped in front of me and tossed her hair at him. That did it. His hands dropped, his jaw dropped, and the other two hands still holding swords dropped as well.
He's charmed now,
Melina said over her shoulder, her gaze locked on Loki.
You can kill him and get this over with.
No, we don't want to kill him, I said.
Why not?
Because if we do, Hel will know it and launch her army out of spite. Ragnarok will begin. Hel would much rather start the show with Loki than without him, see? She has daddy issues and doesn't want to win without his approval and participation, so if you keep him busy, we'll be in good shape.
How do you know this?
Loki's been looking for me for about 4 months now. Well, he's been sleeping for most of it, but still. Hel didn't make a move in all that time except to protect him. Roxana, the witch with a mass of curly hair tightly bound behind her in a ponytail, spoke up in her proper diction.
You want us to keep him charmed for an extended period.
Yep, I grinned at her. Melina snorted.
This man is extremely unstable, and it will take a lot of work to keep him calm. You saw that it took several of us to subdue him just now. What do we get out of this, Mr. O'Sullivan?
Well, you get a world without Ragnarok, for starters. And I can buy you all some of those shiny black boots you tend to like.
That is unacceptable. I might as well let him go right now.
You'd help bring about the end of the world?
He seems to want to end you first, Mr. O'Sullivan. So tell me, why shouldn't we let him go?
I can score you some Girl Scout cookies. You can't get Thin Mints in Poland, can you?
Be serious.
Samoas, then? Melina simply glared at me. All right, I said. What do you want?
You have given me the impression that we'd not be only saving your life, but saving the world. We need more than cookies for that.
I knew it. If you give a witch a cookie, she's going to ask you for a glass of milk.
Understood, Melina. But what? I don't know what you think I can give you.
I want Poland to be free of vampires.
A silence grew in the field, and Grognuel eventually broke it by saying,
Is she trying to be funny?
When and for how long? I asked.
After Ragnarok comes and goes, or in a year. If we are here, and you are here, and vampires are here, you keep Poland vampire-free by whatever means necessary.
All big ifs, but all right, it's a deal. 1 month of keeping Loki captive equals 1 year of vampire-free Poland.
That is acceptable.
We shook hands on it. By the way, I said, Hel has this hound called Garm who can track anything, even across planes. She will send him to find Loki. When he does, Hel will bring an army of the damned to protect her father. Good luck with that. Oh, and Artemis and Diana are on my tail, so they'll be coming through here soon looking for someone to shoot. Bye, gotta run! I gave her a short wave and took off running west. Grognuel and Oberon followed.
What?
Melina's outrage was plain.
Mr. O'Sullivan, come back!
I grinned and kept running. It wasn't every day I got the best of Melina. I was sure to pay for it in the future, but in the meantime, you have to surf the waves that come your way, and this one was Super Shaka Narnar. Chapter 6.
I cannot share the euphoria I feel, because Atticus would take me to task. His eyebrows would draw together, and he would attempt to convey through his expression how very, very old he was, and as a comparative youngster, even a whippersnapper, I could not possibly know how inappropriate it would be to feel euphoric. But I cannot help but feel that way, even though we are running for our lives. Because we are running fast through satin darkness, with strength coursing through our bodies, a percussive core of hooves and paws tapping out a rhythm of flight, clods of earth kissing us farewell and swishes of grass caressing our ankles, like the soft fingertips of mothers who don't want to let their children leave home, but know that they must. They let go, but keep contact as long as they can, extending hands and arms until their children finally pass beyond their reach. And then they feel sad, yet proud, and live on a kernel of hope that someday their children will come back to them and say, Mother, I am home. That is the source of my euphoria. I feel a mother's love with every step I take on the earth. Wherever I go now, I am welcomed home, embraced and adored and supported. I am a druid of Gaia, beloved of the earth, and the wonder of it is still fresh in my heart. When I was a child unbound, in my old life, my mother and stepfather used to take me to places with mountains and trees for family vacations, since we lived in the flattest part of the country and saw little of nature but the sky and amber tops of wheat fields. Walking through the forest and touching the white trunks of aspens, I suspected that the trees kept secrets, but they would tease me, using the wind in their leaves to whisper of mystery, and then rustle and fade, dry chuckles of merriment at my expense. The ginger girl from the plains. I thought the aspen groves must know something important, something cool, because when they loomed over my head and whispered amongst themselves, they shook slightly in their excitement. But now the world is undressed for me, naked and gorgeous and waiting for me to explore it, and all its secrets would be vouchsafed to my ears if I simply took the time to ask. I know we're in terrible danger. It's the kind that Atticus kept warning me about. He tried to scare me into quitting my apprenticeship so many times. And it's true we have been in a whole lot of danger ever since he began the binding process. Still, though we are running for our lives, it's all I can do to keep from busting out a barbaric yop like Walt Whitman. Now, there was a man who knew how to celebrate life and tell us about it. Atticus prefers the British poets and has memorized all of Shakespeare, but while sublime, the bard dwells too much on the dark side of human nature to capture my unswerving devotion. During my training, I had to memorize a large body of work as a first step to learning how to operate in different headspaces, so I chose Walt Whitman's. Whitman saw the world for the endless wonder it was. He called grass the handkerchief of the Lord. I wish I could go back in time and tell him how deliciously close to the truth he'd been. It's Gaia's handkerchief, Mr. Whitman, but you got the rest right. The smallest sprout shows there is really no death, and if ever there was, it led forward life. All goes onward and outward, nothing collapses. And to die is different from what anyone supposed, and luckier. Not that I look forward to dying any time soon, or that the Morrigan's death was lucky. But I think she must be well on one of the Irish plains now, at peace in the green somewhere. I will ask Atticus later, when the shock of her end is not so fresh. It is an object lesson that even gods are not eternal. I do look forward to a long life if I can secure it. For one thing, I still want to memorize the works of T.S. Eliot in addition to those of Whitman. I need to keep adding new headspaces. And there are more languages to learn. Plenty of love to be made. And Gaia to protect with all of my skill. Considering Atticus, though, I can see that eventually my giddiness will fade. I'm not sure that, having lived so long and seen so much, he has the ability to feel wonder anymore. Well, except where I'm concerned. For some reason, he thinks a freckly girl from Kansas is something new, and I confess that my vanity is content to let him think so without protest. He is a man unlike any other, and I love him. And I know without doubt that he loves me back. We are bound, he and I have seen it. Yet he is still a mystery to me. If he feels the love from Gaia that I feel, as I know he must, then how can he maintain his laissez-faire attitude toward pollution and extinction? He only bestirs himself to outrage if a magical threat to the Earth presents itself, but I think most of the mundane threats are every bit as horrific. If we can somehow outmaneuver the Olympians and our other enemies, I will defend the Earth from those who defile it, fiercely, starting with my stepfather's oil company. Atticus thinks I overreact to such things. Perhaps I am an extremist. Or perhaps he's fallen prey to apathy like so many others, worn down and weary and too worried about who's chasing him to muster any outrage at desecrations petty or grand. He has a point. There is plenty to worry about now. But there's so much to cherish, too, like the smell of turf and the wind in my mane. I have a mane! And the effortless way I can leap over fences. This run has been a salve for what Bacchus and hell left raw. Atticus and I enjoyed a nice interlude in Mexico, but that was more about us than about my bond with Gaia. Now, touching a new patch of earth with every step and feeling the energy waiting there, I am beginning to understand the scope of my gift and the size of my new responsibility. The number of obstacles and changes of direction required to stay hidden in Poland far exceeds anything we saw in Hungary or Slovakia. Granted, our route is taking us roughly parallel with E40, a major thoroughfare in the southern end of the country. It is no wonder that we find it more densely populated. But it has slowed us down a bit, and I'm sure our average speed has dropped as a result. We do not know how fast the huntresses are moving, or even if they're still behind us. I keep thinking they will drop down from the sky and put an arrow through our chests and all our running will come to naught. But in the absence of information, we must act on the vague instructions of the Morrigan. We snuck into Katowice about an hour before sunrise, a bona fide metropolis of millions. Atticus worried about our disconnect with the Earth the entire time, and I empathized completely, but pretended it wasn't that big a deal. Inside, I was all, ew. I didn't like the dead feeling of asphalt. Honestly, I didn't know how he managed to wear sandals on a regular basis when he didn't strictly have to. I'd go barefoot all the time if I could. But the sneaking was necessary. I needed some more throwing knives since they had proven their efficacy so well. We had no other ranged weapons, short range as the knives were. We found a sporting goods retailer by snatching the smartphone of a despondent clubber and conducting a search. Said clubber wore a gray suit and a forlorn expression. I think it was near dawn, like 5:30, the hour when early risers are brewing coffee and making bacon, though the sun had yet to hint that it would be arriving soon. The clubber had yet to find a bed where he could get started gestating a legendary hangover. He was weaving uncertainly on the sidewalk and softly slurring his way through a song of self-pity. He must have struck out on his quest to score, because he was staggering through the streets alone with a half-empty bottle of Zubrówka, a favorite drink in Poland that Atticus claims is a rather tasty vodka. And thus, I added the Polish drink of choice to my bucket list and learned that other people's electronic devices can be a fugitive's friend. Traffic was still light to non-existent, consisting almost entirely of early morning delivery vehicles. While the street was clear, Atticus put the phone back in the man's pocket as I dispelled my invisibility for a few seconds in his full view, a finger resting provocatively on my lower lip, giving him a come-hither look under a streetlight. His jaw and the bottle of Zubrówka dropped at the same time. It shattered, drawing his eyes to the sidewalk, and I took the opportunity afforded by his distraction to disappear again.
"That was mean,"
Oberon said, watching the man look wildly around for me and pawing at his eyes as if to clear them. "Why?" I asked. "I've done him no harm."
"Yes, you have. You will haunt him for the rest of his life. I know from experience."
"You're haunted by someone flashing you on a street corner?"
"No, it was a dog park. Atticus and I were just arriving, and she was leaving."
"Oh, here we go."
"She was so fit, and her coat was tightly curled, and she had a perfect poof on the end of her tail like a tennis ball. I saw her for maybe 5 seconds, until she hopped into a Honda, and her human drove her away. And now, I can't see a Honda without seeing her."
"But that's a good thing, isn't it? Kind of romantic? A vision of perfection you can treasure forever, unspoiled by reality."
"Well, I don't know. In reality, I'd like to try spoiling her if she was in the mood."
"Look, Oberon, that man is lonely. He's too skinny and sweaty, and I'm willing to bet you 5 cows that he's socially awkward, or he wouldn't be staggering drunk at this hour. But now, for the rest of his life, he will remember the naked woman on the street who looked at him with desire. When people treat him like something untouchable, he will have that memory to comfort him."
"Or obsess over. What if he starts wandering the streets every night looking for you?"
"Then he's misunderstood the nature of beauty. It doesn't stay, except in our minds."
"Oh, I think I see. That's true, clever girl. Sausage never stays because I eat it, but it's always beautiful in my mind."
We left the man and hurried to the sporting goods store, a place called Vajovnica, which turned out to be only a few blocks away. I toyed with the idea of snagging some other weapons, but they were impractical in this situation. We had no way to carry them, and cinching me up with saddlebags would be a terrible idea once I shapeshifted to anything else. Our best bet was to stay fast and unencumbered. I didn't like stealing, but I didn't see an alternative. No one offers traveler's checks for druids on the run. I would prevail upon Atticus to send the targeted store an anonymous windfall later, if there was a later. Oberon bellyached a bit about carrying knives in his mouth again, a pointless complaint since Gaia's strength ensures our jaws never cramp or ache, but he has been uniformly delightful otherwise. I think his ability to live in the present keeps Atticus from panicking.
"I've never won this far before,"
he said at one point,
"or this fast for so long. It's better than sticking your head out a car window, that's for sure."
My theory is that Oberon might be a master of Tao. He always sees what we filter out. The wind in the grass and something in the sky, sun or moon, shining on our backs as we run. They are gifts that humans toss away like socks on Christmas morning, because we see them every day and don't think of them as gifts anymore. But new socks are always better than old socks. And the wind and grass and sky, I think, are better seen with new eyes than jaded ones. I hope my eyes will never grow old.
Chapter 7. I really wish castles had never become passé. I didn't shed a tear at the passing of the feudal system or the chamber pot, but I've always loved the castles themselves. They're so much fun to invade and take down from within, and they often have secret passages and catacombs and a tower, ivory or not, in which someone important usually lives and rarely comes down. Sometimes they have libraries with old tomes written in a crabbed Latin script, full of alchemical recipes or musings on the mysteries of magical arts, complete with idiosyncratic spellings. I get nostalgic for the old days whenever I see European architecture that evokes the Age of Castles, and Poland is liberally peppered with those sorts of buildings. Perhaps it was nostalgia, along with a gnawing rumble of hunger, that encouraged me to stray from the fields and enter a small town in search of food. Well, that and the insistence of my hound. Aside from a side trip into Katowice to snag some knives for Grognewail, we had run all through the night, and Melina's coven, presumably with Loki, was more than 200 miles behind us. Around mid-morning, my hound snapped us out of the running zone we were in.
"I am going to eat these knives if you don't feed me soon,"
Oberon said. I immediately felt guilty. With Gaia replenishing our strength and with so much else on my mind, I hadn't thought much of food. Our ability to snag 3 squares a day had been destroyed. We had become opportunists, snatching melons or whatever we could along the way, and once we scarfed it down, even though it was never enough, we kept thinking we'd run across something else soon. Too often, we didn't. "Okay, you've certainly been patient. How does prime rib sound?"
Sorry, clever girl. I just drooled all over your knives. Blame it on Atticus. He said prime rib. For breakfast. I'm all for that, as long as there isn't any horseradish on it."
After a moment, he added, obviously speaking to Grognewail,
"You like horseradish? Well, I guess you have a good excuse being a horse, but that doesn't explain why anybody else likes it."
I'm not guaranteeing prime rib, mind you. I just wanted to know how it sounded.
"What? You mean you were messing with me?"
"Well, not exactly. We'll look for it, but I'm not sure we'll find a place that serves it. I'm just saying you may have to settle for something else."
"I hope not, but I'm hungry enough to settle."
We were about 15 miles southwest of Wrocław, crossing more farmland, when we came across a road marked E67. Looking south along the road, we saw some buildings. It was one of the many wee villages scattered throughout the country. "Let's see if they have a place to eat in that town," I said. A couple of minutes brought us into a hamlet called Puczkow Wojciechowski, and there we found an interesting rural hotel with a restaurant attached called Gosznyc pod Furo. It was a white building with black boards accenting it in diagonal slashes, Tudor style, which was a surprise in itself. Wagon wheels braced the sign, so I guess the name of the place had something to do with wagons. Red and pink flowers and hanging pots dangled from the eaves, and the property thrived with burgeoning hedgerows and cultured gardens. We went around to the back, where the garbage and the woodshed were, and spied the kitchen door. It was open to let out some of the heat from the grill fire, only a screen door present to keep out insects, and through it we could hear sizzling and the clack of a pair of tongs by a chef waiting to flip a breakfast steak. The breakfast grill looked shoehorned into the layout of the kitchen, a clear afterthought and a recent addition. Since it was the only restaurant in town, demand for breakfast must have eventually convinced the owners to supply it. A waiter called out an order, but it was lost on me. I still needed to learn Polish. Grognewail and I shifted to human and leaned our weapons against the back wall, leaving Oberon to guard them. We camouflaged ourselves, and Grognewail drew on my bear charm to keep her spell-powered, since she didn't have her own charm yet. Interesting fact. It is really fun to sneak into a restaurant kitchen stark naked. I nearly collided with a stern-looking waitress, who would have no doubt kicked me in the package if she saw me. She had a severe beauty that was probably softened by a smile in the dining area or when surrounded with good company, but out of sight of the customers, customers who may decide not to tip well, her face was taut and unforgiving. There was one other waiter, a younger man who clearly feared the waitress and made way for her, and a chubby, jolly cook in an apron and sweatband working two grills. One was a wood fire for steaks and pork chops, and the other was the flat metal kind for scrambling some eggs and frying bacon. I liked him instantly because of the faint smile on his face as he worked. Maybe he was just thinking about a funny joke, or the smile on his lover's face, but my intuition was that he was a soul at peace with the artistry of his job. A few minutes' observation revealed that he never turned around to face the server area unless he had a plate to deliver or a ticket to look at. He kept his attention on the grills otherwise. The two servers spent more time out in the dining area than they did in the kitchen. The cook eventually put up four plates, two with pork chops and eggs and two with pancakes and bacon. Oberon would be grateful for any of that. But a place like this might serve prime rib sandwiches for lunch. If so, they had to put the slow-cooking prime rib in the oven in the morning. That meant it was available for breakfast if you liked it ultra-rare, which Oberon did. The oven was behind the serving area, but also behind the wood-fire grill's stone walls, which allowed me to tiptoe back there and open the oven without being seen. The large hunk of meat that greeted me elicited a smile, because I knew how happy Oberon would be. I removed it and rested the prime rib on a prep area next to the oven. I found a couple of carving knives and a plate and sliced off a generous hunk of bloody beef for my friend. Granuel snagged the pork chop plates and stole the bacon sides from the pancakes while the waiters were out of the kitchen, and the cook never noticed. The pancakes she left behind utterly failed to raise the alarm. I felt sorry about the inevitable argument that would erupt when our theft was discovered. Especially sorry to give the waitress an excuse to yell at the cook, but we were hungry and in a hurry, and nobody's lives were at stake but ours. "Try to chew it slowly and enjoy it," I said, putting the plate down for Oberon.
"Oh, great big bells, Atticus," he said as he laid into it. "This is the best prime rib ever."
He gave a soft whine of appreciation.
"Stolen and succulent, like forbidden fruit when I'm already starving. This shall be known as the great meat heist of Poland at one time. All future meals will be measured against this one. It's even better than the big juicy barbecue of Atlanta that other time, remember that? Or the beloved boar sausage of Scotland we had once. And do you remember the heinous worldwide bacon shortage of 2013? This totally makes up for it."
"Glad you like it, buddy. There's no shortage of bacon here. In fact, you can have mine."
"You're giving me prime rib with a side of bacon? I love you, Atticus. If I ever have puppies, I'm going to tell them stories about this food. It's legendary."
A heated exchange of Polish boiled through the screen door, and my pork chops tasted of guilt sauce. We had to chow down anyway. Any meal at this point could be our last. The waitress and the cook eventually broke it off, and she exited the kitchen, no doubt to inform her customers that their breakfast would take a bit longer. We were just about finished when two large ravens descended with thunderous back wings that sounded like chopper blades. Each of them had a familiar white gleam in one eye. They landed on the woodpile and squawked at me. "Hugin and Moonin," I said, "to what do I owe the pleasure?" One raven, I couldn't tell them apart, squawked and shoved his beak in my direction, then squawked again while pointing with his beak to the other raven. "You want me to talk to that one?" "Hi there." "Oh, I see." It wanted me to mentally bond with the other raven. Activating my charm for magical sight, I had to blink a little bit at the intensity of white magic emanating from the two birds. But once I could focus, I found the consciousness of the indicated raven and reached out to it. Images slammed into my head, aerial views of Artemis and Diana racing across the Polish border near Dukla, each of them in a fancy new chariot pulled by four golden-horned stags. They were running side by side, following our trail across a familiar alfalfa field, when the earth gave out from under them and they fell into our pit trap. They tried to leap out of the chariots and make it back to solid ground, but weren't in time. They'd been moving quickly, and the stags pulled those floating chariots down. A grindhouse of gore and screaming ensued. Though I felt sorry for the stags, I didn't feel the least bit distressed at seeing the goddesses impaled on the wooden pikes we'd left at the bottom. They'd have to heal up from that, somehow get out of the pit, and get yet another brace of chariots and new teams to pull them. They'd be going a bit slower, but they would never give up now that I had personally wounded them. I needed a long-term solution more than ever, and I didn't have one. The scene shifted. Artemis and Diana in the gray sky of an early dawn. It must have been the same one we experienced a few hours ago, looking none the worse for suffering what would be mortal wounds to anyone else, and gathering themselves to begin again outside the pit. They had new chariots, new stags, and now a pack of seven hounds each. I remembered the hounds from mythology. They had been gifts from Pan and Faunus. Each goddess blew into a horn, and the hounds leapt ahead on our trail. They waited for a few seconds and then followed behind in their chariots. If we tried another pit trap, the hounds would fall in first, and the huntresses would be able to see that in time to avoid it. But it had worked. It had taken us about 8 hours to get from the pit trap to here, and it was about 3 hours after dawn now, so if the huntresses began at dawn, that meant they were about 5 or maybe 6 hours behind us now. The link broke, and the raven I'd bonded with, clearly Moonin since I'd seen a memory, pointed at the other one, Hugin. Hugin's aura was a bit more intense. The current thoughts of Odin would of course be more active than his memories. I didn't think Hugin represented the totality of Odin's thoughts, but it had to be a relatively huge chunk of his consciousness, or else it wouldn't have put Odin in a coma for years when I'd speared the first Hugin back in Asgard. I had no idea how Odin thought of him, but from a druidic perspective, Hugin was a headspace in Odin's mind, with wings. And in a similar sense, Moonin was a headspace as well. Both ravens had to report back to Odin periodically to recharge and reunite all the fragments of his consciousness, but it wasn't as if he sat with all the life of a mannequin while they were gone. Though they did embody the mind of Odin, they weren't the full sum of it. I connected with the bird's bright threads of consciousness, and the aged whiskey voice of the Grey Wanderer filled my head with Old Norse.
"Keep running. You cannot ever stop for long. We are doing what we can to prevent the Svartalfar from interfering further."
"That's very kind, but how did you hear I was in trouble?"
"The Morrigan told me."
"The Morrigan is dead."
"Precisely. 9 months after we met in Oslo, she returned and gave me a ruby that was bound to her. It glowed with power. Someday, she told me, this ruby will cease to glow, and you will know that I am dead. And when that happens, you must protect the druids from the Dark Elves if you wish them to fight with you in Ragnarok. It did not make sense at the time. She said druids, but there was only you. And I did not understand why the Svartalfar would be so important. But now it makes sense. You have enough problems without the Svartalfar on top of them."
"She foresaw this 5 or 6 years ago?"
"She was a deeper one than any of us suspected."
I let that eulogy pass unremarked. "Odin, how did you find me? I'm shielded from divination."
"Your woman isn't."
"She's not mine. She belongs to herself."
"I care not. Run now. I want you to fight in Ragnarok, or I want to watch the huntresses flay you alive. I find myself deliciously ambivalent."
"You've been watching?"
"Of course. The view is quite lovely from Hlidskjalf,"
he said,
referring to the Silver Throne from which he could observe events in most of the Nine Realms.
I am not the only one with an interest here, and you should probably be informed. The Olympians have claimed the right to take your life. But there are gods of other pantheons who wish to keep you alive for other purposes, myself among them.
What other gods? Odin continued as if I hadn't spoken.
After the Morrigan fell, these other gods informed Olympus that if you are to die, it must be accomplished through skill and not overwhelming force. They are permitted to hunt you, in other words, and if they are successful, so be it. But the Olympians may not fly here en masse to confront you.
Who can dictate this to the Olympians?
Humanity has created more powerful gods. The Olympians would not wish to cross them, nor would I. Zeus and Jupiter saw you building that pit trap, you know. And we saw them see it. They were going to warn the Huntresses and spoil the surprise. But we stopped them. That wouldn't have been fair. Or half so amusing.
Thinking back to a particularly vivid dream I had 12 years ago in Flagstaff, I asked, might one of those gods be Ganesha? Odin ignored me again.
It works the other way, too, so I caution ye against using modern transport. The Olympians insisted ye must escape under your own power. Should ye board an aircraft or a vehicle, the Olympians will be allowed to stop ye.
So, we are entertainment for the gods. We run for your sport.
Ye must understand how rare this is. Your actions cannot be divine or reliably predicted. The outcome cannot be known, and thus it is exciting. And there are others interested in your demise, apart from the Olympians, which makes this more interesting.
What others?
Ye have already seen them. Vampires. Dark Elves. As to the latter, the Losalfar are coming to Midgard to keep the Svartalfar out of your way. They are anxious to fight their dark brethren on neutral ground, and for once they know roughly where to find them, wherever you're headed.
So, we're not only entertainment, we're a method by which someone gets to pursue a personal grudge.
It is a role you've played before. The Aesir were on the receiving end, if you recall. A small matter involving Thor.
I recalled. It was not my finest hour. I suppose you won't be helping us then?
On the contrary. As I said, we will do our best to take care of the Dark Elves. And I also told you to run, which was outstanding advice.
The link broke, and the raven's wings blatted into the morning sky like fat motorcycle engines. The Morrigan's assertion that we had to run the whole way made a bit more sense now. The gods had decided Europe was their Colosseum, and we were the gladiators. No rest for the druids, I said. Come on, let's go.